My name's Toby O'Jean. I hope no one read my abstract. I'm totally changing my talk. I've given that talk so many times, I couldn't bring myself to do it again. And now after seeing your guys' talks, I thought, well, gosh, that talk would have fit much better. But anyhow, what I'm going to focus on today is a newer study that my program's investigating. And it's a lot of my work in the past is focused on understanding the hydrology of an experimental catchment, maybe a small 30-hectare catchment. And now it's evolving to trying to understand the regional hydrology of the Sierra Nevada, from the foothills, all the way up to the High Sierras. And it's part of an NSF critical zone project. Excuse me.
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
Hopefully you've got the power now.
I'm going to go ahead and just see if I can advance while you guys are working. So let's see. Let me try to just explain the geographic setting of our project. So we're looking at a transect that spans the cap of the Sierras down to the foothills. And that spans about 3,000 meters of elevation. At the lowest elevation, about 400 meters, we have three catchments that we have across this transect. The lowest elevation is at 400 meters. It's an oak woodland, Mediterranean environment, gets about 50 centimeters of precipitation in the wintertime. The next elevation up is at about 1,100 meters, and that's a mixed coniferous forest. It's about 65 centimeters to 70 centimeters of precipitation, mainly as rain, occasional snow melt, snow storms coming in. Then our third catchment is at 2,000 meters in elevation, and that's predominantly snow, and that gets to about 130 centimeters a year. And again, these are Mediterranean climates, so most of the precipitation is falling in the winter, and so these forests are relying on storage for their productivity. We have a fourth catchment, which is at... Oh my gosh, are you okay?
Yeah,
like in the sixth, called the eighth. This is going to sound, I think they're recording.
Technical difficulties
really
are one thing. Okay, I think you're good.
Okay. So our highest elevation site, which is at 2,700 meters, gets about 170 centimeters of rainfall. And as I mentioned, storage is really what we're after here in understanding the relationships between hydrology and forest productivity and also stream flow generation. And so this is a very young project. We only started this about a year ago. So please bear in mind that we're just learning about this area. This is the transect. You can see those red solid dots there at the lower part. Oh, where am I? Here we go. This is our transect extending from 400 to 2,700 meters. The talk today is going to focus on these three catchments, 400 meter elevation, 1,100, and 2,000. And so the soils vary differently across this gradient, as you can imagine. This is what I call a bioclimatic gradient. Lithology is pretty constant. It's a granodiorite. The things that are changing are elevation and climate and vegetation in response to that climate. And so we're trying to understand how soils and deep regolith are changing across this gradient. Entisols, for those of you that understand soil taxonomy, at 400 meters elevation, so weakly developed soils. At 1,100 meters, we have alfisols, pretty strongly developed soils. At 2,000 meters, it goes down to inceptisols and entisols again, very weakly developed soils. And then at the peak, we have very weakly developed soils also, but these have been glaciated, so the time factor is all out of whack at this high elevation. So I'm going to exclude that from the talk today. And so this figure is showing ET across this gradient of elevation on the x-axis, ET across the y-axis. This is from flux towers. So we have flux towers situated at each of these catchments. And what you see is that we're moisture limited, obviously, in the oak woodland, low elevation site. Temperature limited at the high elevation site due to extreme extreme cold, so there's a dormancy going on in the wintertime at that elevation. But at 2,000 and 1,100 meters in elevation, this is kind of the sweet spot for evapotranspiration. These trees are essentially transpiring year-round, with maybe a few pauses and extreme cold periods in the winter. But for the most part, they're utilizing water year-round. And they're utilizing quite a bit of water, 800 millimeters, roughly. And the fundamental question, which is probably not that hard to answer, is where are these trees getting their water? If it's all falling during the wintertime, storage is the big factor that's holding that water for utilization. If you look at soil survey, it's going to report that the soils have a water holding capacity of 26 centimeters at 1,100 meters and 20 centimeters at 2,000 meters. So there's just not enough water there. So luckily, Dr. Graham has discovered, it's no secret, that deep regolith is the reservoir of water that these trees rely upon to survive throughout the year. And so what we're trying to do is expand on Bob Graham's work to understand the spatial patterns in deep regolith across this gradient. And so our overarching goal is to understand how deep regolith governs ecosystem services and ecosystem resilience to climate change. And so understanding those patterns of thickness across the Sierras is going to lead to a greater understanding of how climate change is going to influence stream flow generation and the resiliency of forests to these changes. So specifically what I'm trying to answer is, what governs regolith thickness across this transect? Can soil forming factors and digital soil mapping techniques explain weathered bedrock characteristics? And to what extent does soil variability, as documented by soil survey, to what extent could that be used as a scaling mechanism to predict deep regolith across this transect? So what I'm going to do now is just try to talk about these three of these catchments, starting with the 400-meter elevation site. And we have different levels of information from each one because it's a pretty new project. So at 400 meters in elevation, we've studied quite a bit. We've spent a couple of years working at this site, so we know a little bit more. So our first goal was to understand how terrain attributes redistribute water, and can we predict soil moisture variability from terrain attributes alone. And these are the different terrain attributes. We have slope, tangential curvature, plan curvature, compound topographic index, a series of terrain attributes or derivatives that we use to predict redistribution of water. And so we're doing it at three depths, 10 centimeters, 30, 50. We're trying to predict mean water content and the change in water content across what we call these post-rainfall periods. The storms are so flashy in California that we don't model during a storm event. We're trying to model between storm events. So that's what we call those post-rainfall periods. We had essentially seven storm events, and these are those different events. These are the periods between them. And really, this graph is just showing the partial Spearman correlation of the terrain attribute to either mean water content or change in water content. And what this really says is that in these simple soil landscapes, undeveloped soils that are relatively shallow to hard bedrock, a lot of different terrain attributes work to adequately explain the variability of soil moisture during the storm events. But what they didn't work as well on is when water is being extracted through evapotranspiration. So they tended to be not as effective in those later storms. And so we developed another statistical multiple regression model that tried to couple one of our better terrain attributes, compound topographic index, with beam radiance as a proxy for aspect, and then the weighted mean particle diameter, which is a proxy for the storage capacity of the soil. And what we found is that we could adequately explain the variability or the variance in soil moisture across these different depths, across these different post-rainfall events, much better than we have been able to do in other landscapes that have more complicated soil. So we had some degree of confidence that, hey, well, we can, in granitic landscapes, predict how terrain is routing water in the landscape. And then we wanted to take the next step further, because what we really want to do is be able to model soil variability across these landscapes. And what we did is we created a logistic regression model, and then used redundancy analysis to understand how we could predict the character of a soil in these granitic landscapes. And the character of the soil is defined, we defined it as the clay content, the redness of the soil, the cation exchange capacity of the soil, and the thickness of the soil. And we used terrain, we used compound topographic index, we used lithology and depth. And when you combine those three characteristics, we were able to describe about 60%, 66% of the variance in soil properties using this digital mapping technique. And so, not bad, much better than in other places that we've tried this approach. So we're relatively confident that digital soil mapping techniques and terrain, use of terrain attributes can effectively help us understand the patterns of soils and water in these landscapes. The problem is that research was done at 400 meters in elevation. That's a simple, essentially, pile of sand overlying hard bedrock. We're going into these upper reaches of the Sierras where the soils are more well developed, the thickness is much greater, so we need to see if those techniques can work in those different catchments. So I just wanted to show you what we know about these other catchments. This is some drilling work that we did at 400 meters, 1100 meters, and 2000 meters. And what we see is that regolith thickness increases with increasing elevation. We did some geophysics at these two higher elevation sites, the 1100 meters and the 2000 meters. This is essentially based on the fact that geophysical travel velocities are slowed by increasing porosity, and they're much faster with hard bedrock. And what these figures show is that here we have pretty thick regolith, almost maybe 30 meters of thickness at 2,000 meters, thinner but still relatively thick at 1,100 meters, approximately 10 meters of regolith thickness, the blue being what we think is the hard bedrock. And this is a little bit disturbing in that it doesn't look like topography is going to be a great tool to be able to describe the variability of thickness across this landscape. This is the natural topography of this site, and this is that here. Maybe there's some relationships at the higher elevation, but at the mid elevation, it's not looking good. And so we're going to have to rely on other tools, possibly, to better understand this. Or maybe we just didn't have a big enough window of land to run the geophysics. It's limited to about 300 meters horizontal distance. The authors of this paper also were able to model the porosity of this material, showing that the porosity was roughly up to 50% at the soil surface, down to zero in the hard bedrock. And so we're getting confident that we're learning more about the spatial patterns in this material. Why do we need to know this? Obviously, it's the storage in these soils that we're after. This is what's going to support the plant canopies in times of deficit. And you can see just a rough estimate of plant available water in this higher elevation site. It stores about 76 centimeters of water, which is about what they were transpiring at that elevation. Whereas at the 1100 meter elevation, it stores only about 34 centimeters of water. There's evidence that suggests that the trees are using water to about maybe 400 centimeters, probably even deeper. Some colleagues have some data that suggests that there's capillary action that's allowing water to move upward in the soil profile to depths as deep as 15 meters. So this is just showing a neutron probe of water content in the right after snowmelt versus all these, which were late in the season. And so you're just seeing this difference seems to be most prolific to a depth of 4 meters. So the interesting thing to me about this is kind of the head scratcher is this is a figure showing, where's my pointer, elevation across the x-axis, regolith thickness across the y-axis, and degree of soil development on the other y-axis. And so you see degree of soil development peaks at 1,100 meters, whereas regolith thickness peaks at 2,000 meters. And so it just doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. Why is it that where we're having the most intense soil development, do we have thinner regolith production or less regolith production? And so this is the kind of the teeth of what we're trying to understand now in the future is why are these two, I guess, similar processes decoupled? This is a map showing what we call the red soil zone. And this area represents this peak zone of soil development that I show here. The red soil zone transforms or is seen across all variety of different lithologic or lithologies, andesite, granite, basalt. So we see this high degree of weathering in this band, this elevational band, that extends between 1,000 and about 1,800 meters of elevation. And so why is it that the bedrock is not responding to that same trend? Why is it transposed to a higher elevation? We don't really have a lot of answers at this point. One thing that popped into our minds that we really needed to figure out first was it a lithologic difference? Were we seeing differences in the parent material at 1,100 meters, which would make it less physically weatherable than the material at 2,000 meters? And this is just an X-ray powder mount of those two sites at a piece of core that was at the bedrock soil interface. And what we see is there's no real difference. There's some differences in intensity, but it seems to be that there's the same amount of biotite in both of these samples. And biotite is the material that's really responsible for the evolution of hard bedrock to weatherable bedrock. The iron is oxidized and reduces, causing some strain on the minerals, allowing it to just fall apart into a friable material. So the presence of biotite is key in terms of the evolution of deep regolith. So we don't think that it's a lithological difference that's causing these differences in soil and regolith. What is kind of interesting is if you take, this is a map showing the sum of monthly precipitation minus the sum of monthly evapotranspiration. And what we're just very simply showing is surplus in blue, deficit in red, and neutral or equal in white. This is the Central Valley right in here. The foothills are probably right around this margin. That band of intensely weathered soils and relatively shallow bedrock is this white area right in here where precip and ET are roughly in balance. And so it could be just that you get this feedback between utilization and the amount that's coming in that doesn't allow enough deep percolation to essentially let that deep weathered bedrock or the weathered bedrock evolve into a greater thickness. As you move up in elevation, we get a surplus, more deep percolation. Hypothesis would be that there's more than physical weathering of the weathered bedrock. And so an interesting pattern that we see. So finally, I don't know if this slide is very meaningful. The last thing, we don't see, we're a little concerned that topography, terrain attributes might not be an effective way to model patterns, local patterns in weathered bedrock. What we might be, we're hope optimistic that might happen is that variability in soils at the catchment scale might allow us to create a scaling mechanism to understand local patterns in weathered bedrock thickness. And so we certainly see that in a soil survey. If you look at, say, clay content at 1,100 meters compared to clay content at 2,000 meters, scales are very different here. 30 versus 12 at the bottom, we see these huge differences. The shaded area is a 95% confidence interval, and that's the 5% confidence interval. So we see huge differences in the soils at these elevations. And so what we're going to try to follow up on is, can we detect subtle differences in soils within each catchment that could then help explain some of the local variability in the regolith? Thank you. So a lot of big ideas and hand waving in this talk. Not a lot of findings and conclusions. But in summary, what we're headed for is using the terrain attributes to understand the regional patterns in this material. Thank you. But it would be hard to imagine because you know the vegetative cover is actually more robust and the litter layer is even thicker at the lower elevation, 1,100 meter elevation, and so it's puzzling that would be the cause. But that's something that we need to look into with beryllium 10 measurements or something. We have a colleague that specializes in that, and so that will be part of the focus. It has to be addressed. Yeah.
Have you considered the effect of plants of an old forest that no longer exists?
Yeah, the paleo veg, and what that's another part that when I got here, I realized, man, this is all physicists, and so I didn't talk too much about the pedologic perspective, but time. I don't know about paleo vegetation, but time is going to be a complicating factor. What we think, another hypothesis that's going on, is that red soil zone might be an artifact of glaciation, being that at 2,000 meter elevation, it wasn't glaciated, but it could very well have been in like a permafrost condition, freeze dried. And so the pedologic clock could have been stopped, frozen for thousands of years, where at 1,100 meters, it could have been just warm enough so that pedologic process could have evolved at a slower rate. So we might have an asynchrony in time, but it still doesn't really address why the deep regolith is shallower, unless it was an erosional thing. So that's another thing that we're gonna try to tackle. Haven't quite figured out in my mind how we're going to do it. Isotopes, possibly, of the clay minerals might help us understand that. But yes, vegetation could very well play a role too. I don't know. Yeah.
I wonder about water table dynamics in this this puzzle. At the H.J. Andrews, so north of here into the Cascades in Oregon, mm-hmm. we find similar variation on the scale of a catchment. Mm-hmm. And in some of those headwater catchments, the ridge has 7-8 meters of deep regolith saprolite, and near the stream, it's almost zero. And mm-hmm. the reason for that, we think, is that water table surface is kind of pinned at the stream, often due to scour and debris flows, whereas if you go up to the ridge now, the water table is kind of doing this. It's kind of angling from the stream up and down, and that up and down movement really creating that deep zone. I wonder if that could be at work for a pile of
that. That's a good point. And you know what? We see something similar at the highest elevation. At the meadow, we have shallow soil to bedrock, to hard bedrock, and it's permanently saturated. Whereas you move up in the upland landscape, very thick regolith. We have wells. We've never been able to detect a water table, but that's because we've been stuck with three years of drought, and so we've never seen that. We haven't seen any water move. I mean, besides getting a little bit drier. But I suspect you're correct that in a wet year, when we get those atmospheric rivers funneling right into that area, we probably see that dynamic fluctuation. We just haven't been able to detect it yet. But that's a good point.
Okay, thank you very much again.